The Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Thanks for dialing in. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. And on Mondays, we like to start with Elise Glink, and today is no different. Hi, Elise. Welcome back.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
Let's start talking about personal taxes on wealthy business people. What's going on here?
Well, you know, the Democrats are trying to find ways to push through $3.5 trillion in terms of expenses. And so one of the things that President Biden said today, or that he will say a little bit later on, is about his proposal that will raise the corporate tax rate to 26.5% from 21% for businesses that report more than $5 million in income. And on the personal side, the marginal income tax rate would go to 39.6% from 37% if you're reporting taxable income over $450,000, $400,000 if you are unmarried.
Are they going to do anything with income under $400,000?
No, I don't think they really will. But if you make more than $5 million, they're going to give you a 3% surtax, which is expected to raise $127 billion. So $127 billion there. They're expecting to raise a significant amount of money from corporate, raising the corporate taxes. And then they're going to try and close some loopholes so that the $3.5 trillion that seems to, a number that really seems to be causing some numbers for Manchin and others, they're going to close that gap between what they're hoping to spend and the revenue that is going to be brought in.
We don't talk that often about how the money's going to be generated. We just say infrastructure, human infrastructure, roads and bridges, stuff like that. I guess this is should be as important as the other part.
I think it's really important. There was a report that came out over the weekend that due to lack of IRS enforcement, read that as bad software that doesn't really work and not nearly enough people to answer the phones and go after people. Really rich people, the top a percentage, a sliver of the top 1%, are escaping over $100 billion in taxes every year. They're just not simply not paying them because nobody's forcing them to do that. And so I think one of the things that Biden is going to propose today is to beef up enforcement within the IRS to make sure that the software is where it needs to be in order to make sure we're collecting all the taxes that the U.S. is owed.
That sounds to me like the money's there, and then they're putting it in the bank before they actually capture it. That's the sort of funding for a lot of bills that worries me, right? Because sometimes they'll say, well, it's because we're going to realize savings with more efficient government, or in this case, we're going to get more money from the wealthy who aren't paying it. But you haven't done it yet, so I think they sort of count their chickens a little early on these scenarios.
Well, I think that's exactly what happened when Trump pushed through his tax decrease. So there was all this talk about all this revenue that would come from lowering taxes. This is a standard sort of push from the Republican side of things where they say, well, we're going to lower taxes and everything, and then that's going to, you know, create a huge boom in the economy, and then we're going to collect more taxes because of it. And I think that you can look and see that that actually hasn't happened, but they do the same thing on all sides, right? This is what our projection is. We go to the CBOE, we go to the budgeting office, the nonpartisan budgeting office, they tell us exactly what they think will happen, and we're going to go with that.
Well, does the Congress support this? Would this kind of funding pass the muster here?
I think it's really hard to tell right now. I think that right now there are a lot of Democrats who want to spend $3.5 trillion. There are some that don't, and I think you need every single last one to get it through the mill. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
I guess it depends on what the definition of rich is. Whenever they say, well, let's tax the rich more, they need to pay their fair share. I have trouble sometimes with the definitions of rich and fair, because I'm sure plenty of people that make $401,000 a year will tell you they pay a boatload of taxes already. Maybe we should just cut spending rather than taking more money from them.
Well, if you're making $401,000, just to be fair, this is marginal tax increase. So you're going to pay 39.6% of $1,000. It's not that you're paying it on the entire amount.
We talked a little bit about House Democrats' idea about taxing wealthy individuals and businesses. What about the child tax credit? There's also talk in Congress to extend that, right?
Yeah, there is, actually. The Democrats are proposing extending it through 2025. Obviously, people would like to make that permanent. But what's happening right now is that there are millions of families who are getting checks of $300 or $360 per child up to the age it's $3,600 a year up to age six, but it's broken out into monthly payments. And that goes up to people making $150,000 a year for couples and $112,500 for single parents. But those are only set to continue for, I think there's four more payments, and then the rest of that sum would be credited to the families when they file their taxes. But I think that it's been a huge help as we've gone through this pandemic for families to get that extra money, and it's raising kids out of poverty, which is the goal of it.
The idea is to advance the families the money as they need it over the course of the year rather than claiming it and getting it deducted, say, from their taxes or refunded at their taxes. But is it extra dollars per se?
Well, it is in terms of the numbers of people getting it. So the tax credit was typically for families at the kind of the lowest income levels. But they've raised that. And so families who are earning a really significant amount of money, well over $100,000 a year, are actually entitled to get it as well. And I think that that's helped. And it's recognized that in some parts of the country, earning what would be a six-figure income and a solid amount of money just doesn't go as far as it used to.
So is this going to pass? What's the status of this?
I wish I had a crystal ball for you, John. I think it's unclear. I think there's a lot of support behind it. And I think that there are a lot of people who would like it to pass. But again, there are some people looking out going, this is a lot of money we're spending. Where's that revenue going to come from?
Seemed like a lot of the market activity last year was exactly predicated on the rise and fall of vaccines. And remember who was it that was first approved? Was it Pfizer? And suddenly the market just jumped. Are we seeing the same sort of correlation now?
I think people are really, really looking to have the approvals of Moderna and Pfizer for young kids as young as 5 years old. And I think that that right now is what's helping the market have a good day. It's a first good day in a number of weeks, actually. We've seen the markets fall quite a bit. And there's still people who think that there's further to fall. But, you know, when you look out and you see that Pfizer's vaccine may actually be approved as soon as next month, that could be a real boon for everybody, right? Because it just takes another chunk of families out of the area of having to be worried that their kids who might be 7 or 10 years old or even 11 and they don't qualify for that 12-year-old vaccine, that they now can get protected. And in fact, today, this morning, I just heard from a good friend of ours, an attorney that my husband Sam works with, and she and her two kids all have come down with COVID. And her son is, I think, 7, and her daughter is maybe 11 and a half or 12, and just hadn't gotten her vaccine just yet. And they all came down with COVID. And so I think parents who are worried about that are going to be very happy. And that means they're going to go out and they're going to do things in the world. And that's going to be spending money. And that's why the markets go up.
You see a lot of families where the adults aren't wearing the masks, at least until recently, because they didn't have to. And the kids are, because the kids presumably hadn't been vaccinated yet. This would be as young as 5, and that would be for Pfizer. It would still be an emergency use, though, right?
I think so. It's a little bit hard to know how it's going to work. I mean, you've got a two-dose Pfizer shot for adolescents who are 12 to 15, right? It's full approval for 16 and older. They're thinking that they will have at least one shot starting for kids as young as 5. So we'll see how that works out. But this will have nothing to do with the mandates that are going on right now in schools for kids wearing their masks. And it's expected, at least here in the state of Illinois, Cook County, that kids who are going back, whether or not they'll have shots, that they'll still need to wear their masks.
You're following the housing stock. What's the news on that front?
Well, it's interesting. So we've talked a lot about how we're missing, you know, than a quarter million homes in this country. Either, you know, they've gone out of disuse, you know, homes wear out, believe it or not. You've got to renovate them or they can fall apart. Not enough new homes were built. So Realtor.com released some new details about how we got to 5.25 million missing homes. And what they basically said was we had 12.3 million American households formed between 2012 and 2021. 7 million new single family homes were built during that time. So if you think about it, you have 7 million homes and 12 million people, that's 5 million right there. And, you know, they talked a little bit about how it's the homes that are most affordable for first-time homebuyers. Those are the ones we're most missing. There are a lot of homes available for people willing to pay lots and lots of money. And so the price of the homes has really shot up. And so new home builders are actually building more expensive homes than perhaps what is needed, sort of that missing piece.
That's an interesting point. Oftentimes you see these homes coming up in neighborhoods, and they're neighborhoods with beautiful new sparkly homes with quartz countertops, and presumably they're out of reach of first-time home buyers. I wonder what the average price is, and it would depend on the market, of course, but for a brand new home on the market today. Builders are probably incentivized to make them $500,000 homes rather than $150,000 homes, right?
They are in a lot of cases. The median sales price right now for a new home, an affordable new home, is about $300,000. You actually would need to have an income of somewhere around $60,000 to $70,000 to be able to afford a $300,000 home, assuming that you've got a down payment. And a lot of people just don't have that. You know, they're making $70,000, but they don't have a single dollar to put down. And so there's just a mismatch between affordability and what people can actually, you know, pay. The good news right now is that interest rates are very, very low, and they're holding there. The question going forward for the builders is, how long are interest rates going to be under 3%? With inflation, there's some concern that that won't stay. And so interest rates go up, affordability goes down, and that would make it even harder for first-time home buyers.
Well, at least maybe this is happening. I don't know. But were I some sort of social engineer, I would say to the home builders out there, you got to build a bunch of $150,000, I don't know, $200,000 homes so that, and let's have, you know, nice landscaping and paved streets and basketball hoops and make it affordable to people that are just starting out, rather than having to go into compromised neighborhoods or gentrified areas or whatever, you know. Maybe that happens, but I don't think I've driven by those brand new neighborhoods yet.
Right. Well, one of the problems that builders have is the availability of land. So land has gotten very expensive, and on top of land, you still have increased costs for building materials. Yeah. We're having trouble getting the materials shipped over that need to be shipped from other parts of the world. We're not manufacturing everything we need here in the United States, and we don't have enough people who know what they're doing to actually build those homes at an affordable pace. And so the idea that you can build a $150,000 home and it's 3.5, 4 bedrooms and 2 baths and a really nice looking kitchen with not fancy appliances
right,
at all.
Right. I'm reasonable.
Reasonable, right? It's getting very, very difficult to do that. And when, you know, just a standard toilet might cost you, you know, $80 to $150.
Okay, no toilets.
Okay, so we're going back to outhouses. That might be able to be done.
Yeah, I guess it kind of comes to that. And again, I said if I were a social engineer, because in the private sector, if you've got a piece of land and you say, look, we can build a $150,000 house and make $25,000 on it, or we can build a $400,000 house and make $125,000, what are you going to do? You're going to build a more expensive house. So I don't know how this magically happens, but I see the need, the 5 million home gap that you're talking about. That's for sure.
A lot of times, John, you know, when you're looking for land and, you know, you look at, there was a big story a couple of weeks ago about how there were homes in Peoria being auctioned
yeah.
for $1,000, right?
Yeah.
$700.
Yeah.
And then somebody flipped that for $2,000 and then they flipped it for $16,000. So now this, basically, you can't live in it. It's not livable, but you get a piece of land, you know, up against a railroad track or something for $16,000. You could build a $150,000 home there, but maybe the people who can afford that, they don't want to live there. And so we have, or they don't have jobs there. They've got jobs 60 miles away. So there's just a mismatch right now. And you see it actually in the employment world where The jobs that people want are available at a different place around the country. They can't get them over there. They're not taking them here. Same thing with housing.
Fascinating story about those houses in Peoria in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago. Elise Glink, read her stuff at thinkglink.com. We'll talk to you next Monday. Thanks, Elise.
Thank you, John.
Jim Dahlke is the senior editor at Chicago Inno. Jim, we're fascinated by this Airbnb story. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, John. Yes, great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You have an interesting piece that starts out this way. 3 years ago, Nick Akrep and his buddies rented an RV and drove to Tuscaloosa, Alabama for the Alabama-Auburn football game. They went to see a classic college football rivalry, but really they were in search of a tailgate. Unfortunately for them, finding a spot to park and party was not an easy task. Season ticket holders have had their parking passes near the stadium handed down from generation to generation, and no nearby lot had open spaces for his RV. He ended up parking at a Walmart 4 miles from the stadium. So there begins the idea, right, Jim?
That's right. So this founder, Nick Akrep, founded a company called Tail Greeter to solve this exact dilemma that he experienced a few years ago. So essentially what Tail Greeter does is it's a Chicago startup that, like you mentioned, aims to be the Airbnb for tailgating. It lets fans from out of town connect with experienced local tailgaters and join their party for a price. You know, just like Airbnb, hosts can list their space, their price, and how many folks they're willing to accept into their group. And, you know, users can sort of search the platform for a range of different tailgate experiences. You know, maybe you're just looking to join a casual group of cornhole players and throw back a few beers before the game, or, you know, you want to join a more professional type party. They've hosted events on their platform, actually 2,000 people events with live DJs all before big games, ranging from college sports to the NFL, NASCAR, horse races, you know, college football being a big piece of what they're doing. But, you know, essentially what they're doing is kind of creating this problem where if you're visiting a town and you want to kind of get the game day experience, just sort of flying by the seat of your pants and making some last minute decisions doesn't always work out and requires a little more planning sometimes. So that's what Tail Greeter is all about.
Last tailgate I was at, I knew the people that were taking Brenda and I over there. And so I knew 4 people, but there was maybe 20 people at it. And I didn't know the others, but they were friends of friends, and somebody had the girls going, and I suppose we brought something to eat or drink. I guess I'm saying all of that to say this. At first blush, I think, I don't know these people. I don't want to party with them. And I don't know if I want to invite somebody I don't know to the party. But that's probably not an uncommon mix of people who aren't best friends anyway. So maybe the experience works, huh?
You know, and that's actually some of the same criticisms that Airbnb itself had when it first launched a bunch of years ago, right? Why would you want someone to stay in your house? Or why would I want someone to, some stranger, to sleep in my spare bedroom? But, you know, I think what ends up coming down to is, you know, it's a great way to enjoy the experience the same way as you travel into a new city and you want to get to know the local customs and local traditions. You know, you kind of want to party like a local, you know, and that's really what, you know, Tail Greeter is all about, especially in some of these college football atmospheres, you know, where these tailgating traditions have been passed down for years. And really it's, you know, most people, I think they said about 40% of the people that have used their platform actually never end up going inside the stadium. It's really more about the experiencing the party.
Wow. Okay, so this is a local startup. Then I guess I would search, say, the Northwestern game, and maybe I don't have tickets, but the point is I don't have a place to tailgate. I'm going to go to your party, and you're posting your party for sale, if you will, for inclusion at a certain price, right?
That's right. So prices range from anywhere from $15 a person all the way up to $100. They said the founder told me that they've seen tailgates where in Miami, for example, the host of this tailgate flew in lobsters from Maine, did a surf and turf for everybody who showed up there. So the prices, you know, typically come out at about $40 a person. And a lot of these hosts are using this additional revenue actually to pay for their entire tailgate, which has been really interesting to see. And so, yeah, basically what you know, you're paying is the opportunity to get in with the local tailgater and and have some of their food and drink some of their beer and enjoy the atmosphere. And, you know, they are now in close to 100 locations on the platform. They've got 600 different events, mostly around the football season, up on their site right now.
You wrote about Orbital Ventures, Jim. What's that?
Yeah, so Orbital is actually a new fund from a local VC firm called Promise Ventures. They raised $140 million to invest specifically into space startups. Promise Ventures launched several years ago, a very prolific investor around town. They've invested in a lot of well-known firms and have made several space investments along the way, including a couple of publicly traded companies, Rocket Lab and Spire Global. And really what they've seen is that the space sector is a sector they're very interested in, so much so that they've created a fund dedicated specifically to investing in early stage space startups going forward. So, you know, the space tech industry is certainly heating up. There is about $2 billion invested into space startups in 2017. That's increased to $6 billion last year, and over $5 billion has already been invested into the sector in 2021 alone. So they see a lot of opportunity, and, you know, a lot of startups are popping up to kind of continue to help companies enter this next leg of the space race.
Is that for recreation, or is that like to launch low orbit satellites and that sort of thing?
So all of the above. So yeah, they are working to invest in startups that are kind of running the gamut. So they definitely have investments in low orbital satellites. So satellite businesses are a big part of what they're doing, but also the recreational and tourism side of space travel is an area that they're going to pursue as well.
Fascinating stuff as always. Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. Jim, we'll visit again next week. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, John.
It's 12:44. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Let's go back into the newsroom, and this is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Kroger says prices are going up. The nation's biggest selling supermarket chain expects prices to run 2-3% higher in the second half of this year. Kroger, the owner of Mariano's in the Chicago area, blames inflation that's running hotter than management anticipated. Kroger rival Albertsons said earlier this summer it also expected inflation would pick up in the second half of the year and stores would pass along those higher costs. Albertsons owns Jewel-Osco. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Hey, you know, I was thinking, Johnny, we should call it the business of foo today in honor of the Bears game yesterday. The D is missing. No?
Nice. Wow, that just happened.
Yeah. During this pandemic, we've seen Starbucks close briefly because of no workers. Well, you can close a Starbucks. You can't close a dairy farm.
Cows need to be milked at least twice a day, every day. They need to be fed and cared for every day.
That's Linnea Kustra, who knows about dairy farming. She and her husband Joel are multi-generation dairy farmers from Woodstock, Illinois.
Our day starts at 4 and finishes about 7.
That's 4 a.m. to 7 p.m.
7 days a week. So having a dedicated workforce is really essential.
And for the first 20 years they were in business, they could find local help.
We had 3 full-time employees and 2 part-time employees.
But the locals wouldn't stay.
You know, some people say agriculture just wants cheap labor. That's not the case. We had good pay and then good benefits as well, and still we couldn't get people that wanted to work on a farm.
So they began hiring immigrants from Mexico who may or may not have been here legally.
And they had the loyal, hard workers. It was a wonderful experience for us.
In 2018, with anti-immigrant rhetoric red hot, Linnea and Joel were concerned they would lose their employees and not be able to hire more. And
we decided to sell the cows. And it was a very difficult decision for us because it was a career that we truly loved.
So Mrs. Kustera goes to Washington. She testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in July about the need to reform the H-2A visa program. Right now, it only allows seasonal workers to come in and help with harvest and then go home. And that's great for vegetable and fruit farmers, but not dairy, pork, and others that need help year-round. The issue has been kicked down the road for years, but the House passed a bill correcting it, and the Senate is now considering it. And consider this, nearly 80% of the milk in this country is from farms that employ immigrant labor.
They are critical to making sure that we have a sustainable quality milk supply in this country. It's really a national security issue.
Linnea Kustra of Woodstock. It's all red at the Chicago Board of Trade today. Beans are down 1.5 cents. Corn is down about 3.5. And wheat is trading down about 0.5 cents. At the Merck, live cattle are down right at 1% right now. Feeder cattle are down 1.6%. And lean hogs are down 2.8%. From the farm to your belly, today's National Peanut Day. Salted in the shell for me. Preferably be at a baseball game for me. That's the business of Foo on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth, talk to me about Moody's measuring the risk of big companies. What's the story?
Yeah, this was an exclusive that CNN broke a little bit earlier. So Moody's is spending about $250 million to measure the risk of some of the biggest U.S. corporations, the risk of them getting hacked. We've seen some pretty high-profile cyber attacks and some ransoms that I think you and I have talked about, a few of them. So Moody's is going to be, trying to combat that a little bit and assess the risk. Of course, you know, their ratings, their credit ratings can, you know, influence global markets and do quite a bit for various companies. So part of what they're going to do is they're going to be investing in a company that will help them do this rating. And then they become the largest minority shareholder in BitSight. BitSight is the company. So BitSight's also going to acquire a cyber risk rating system created by Moody's and Team 8. It's all kind of all working together. There was a lot of tech firms. It sent me down a lot of different rabbit holes. But essentially, they're going to kind of build themselves as like a think tank focused on these big cybersecurity issues, which I think is really interesting in a moment we're in where we're seeing more and more of that.
So the same way Citi's credits might be measured and announced, so too would your cybersecurity that might affect the rate at which you can borrow money if you're more vulnerable. It would affect your overall rating that way then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, in theory, that's exactly how it would work. And so, part of this is going to be used to improve BitSight's data and risk management products and kind of expand that a little more. You know, BitSight said that its customers are about 20% of Fortune 500 firms. So they already work with some pretty big names. And this will be able to allow them to do more detailed risk assessments. But yeah, my head went the same place that yours did. You know, will this be part of your credit worthiness, including the cybersecurity risk? Because that is, you know, we talked about how insurers have been assessing that and thinking about, you know, how are you insured and are you insured appropriately and enough for those kind of cybersecurity attacks? So adding that into your, you know, your credit worthiness, I think is a really interesting, you know, an interesting thing that I'll be watching closely.
We talk about gold and silver and other commodities, oil, petroleum. We don't talk about aluminum much. Why are you looking at that?
Yeah, we don't talk about it much, but you know, once you start looking at all the things that aluminum informs and all the pieces of the supply chain it touches, it gets pretty interesting. So Goldman Sachs has actually issued a statement about how they're not feeling very optimistic about supply chain issues coming together quite yet. They felt like it's going to be definitely the rest of this year, if not part of 2022. And some analysts even said they felt like it would take maybe up to 5 years to fully resolve all this. But aluminum, just to kind of look at that as an indicator, it reached $3,000 a ton in London for the first time in 13 years. So that's kind of part of that. It surged about 15% over just the last 3 weeks. There's been some supply risk issue. Bauxite mining in Guinea, there was a coup in Guinea that, while it didn't materially affect the bauxite mining, the general unrest in the area, that's considered an increased risk. Alumina refining in Jamaica, and then aluminum smelting in China. And this is where the story kind of gets, there's just so many pieces to it. It's such a large global story when we are thinking about supply chains. But, you know, another issue earlier today, Chinese producers, the news emerged that the Yunnan province in China is going to enforce a production curb this month on aluminum. Mm. Part of that is to meet some energy reduction goals. And also smelters in the EU are also facing some rising costs, some carbon credit issues and power inputs being at record highs. So it's kind of all of these things swirling together to create this, you know, as demand is up for aluminum and other supplies, here's this one indicator that seems like, hey, it may not be too soon before we get all these supply chain issues resolved.
This might have been a story for Jim Dahlke, but you're looking at Chicago's latest billion-dollar firm. Who's that?
Yeah, so I hope I'm saying it right. It's Copado, C-O-P-A-D-O. They were originally in Madrid in 2018. They moved their headquarters here. They've just raised another $140 million. So they are the latest Chicago tech company to be valued at a billion or more. We call those unicorns. They're not as rare as they used to be because we have seen kind of this surge of venture capital flowing into many, many different cities, but certainly here we've seen it, to reach that unicorn status. So that makes it's the 12th to reach unicorn status just this year. So what Copado does is they make software tools that are used by software developers. So people that are writing code for applications on cloud-based platforms like Salesforce, things like that. So that's what Copado does, but they have also reached that status. So we have, you know, it's been interesting at a time when we talk about so many constraints, so many economic constraints, to see this venture capital money flowing into the city has been really interesting.
Every day it seems like somebody's doing really well and somebody's really not, and that's what you get on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy Guth.
Thanks so much, John.